This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to episode 147 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode of the podcast, delighted to be joined by another absolute legend in the music industry. This fella's impact on drumming and music is undeniable. Bev Bevan is my very special guest. We're talking The Move, ELO, Black Sabbath, and of course, Paul Weller. Yes, he played on the Wake Up The Nation album that was released in 2010. And as you'll hear, actually, Bev was second choice. We'll find out why. And we'll talk about his entire career as well, his exceptional talent, that innovative style, that influential presence that have made him so well respected in the music industry and an inspiration to so many up and coming drummers fueling their own musical journeys. This is a real delight. Let's get into it. Bev Bevan, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. We've been trying to set this up for a while, haven't we? So we finally got it together.
Right. We've been chatting for a while, and I'm so glad that you're here because, I mean, there's so much to talk about. There are Weller connections that we'll get into, but I mean, how are we going to cover your career in the time that we have is an impossible job, my friend, because what a career it is, right?
You know, I thank my lucky stars, really, that I've, for my whole life, I've spent doing what I love doing, you know, just playing drums and working with some great people. I had a proper job for one when I left school. I had a job at a departmental store called the Beehive in Birmingham, which, if you remember, Are You Being Served? It was just like that.
I'm free. Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was along with Jasper Carrot, who was my oldest friend.
I saw this connection. This is lovely. So you've been mates from what, over 60 years then?
We met on our first day at grammar school. So when we were 11 years old, and we're still good pals now. So yeah.
Love it. He was such a, I remember him being on TV when I was growing up and just us loving his brand of comedy. I mean, he's so good. So good. I mean, that's a whole separate conversation just about Jasper Carrot as a podcast. But anyway, let's talk about this instrument of choice for you, because I always think the drummer, you have the best view of the entire gig. I mean, occasionally you'll have the singer and the band in front of you and their heads in the way, but you get to see from your pedestal the entire thing, everything going on, don't you?
That's true, actually. I hadn't really thought about it like that, but yeah, you're right. Yes, you do. You get to see everything. You see the audience. You see the backs of lots of musicians' heads. The story about the drums is that I was at school, late 50s, and like lots of other top people at the time, we formed a school band. I mean, there were hundreds of school bands, I'm sure, throughout the country. And I got a few mates, and the lead singer is named Ronnie, and we call the band Ronnie and the Renegades. And I said, well, I'm going to be the singer. And another mate said, well, I want to play guitar. And another, I said, well, I'll play drums. And I'd never picked up a pair of sticks in my life, but I was determined I was going to play drums. And then obviously the first thing I needed was a drum kit. So
yeah.
I went to my mum, and my dad died when I was 10 years old. So it was just me and my mum. I got no brothers or sisters. I had a shop, and we lived above it. And I asked my mum, could I have a kit of drums? I've been into Birmingham. I found this a Broadway kit, and it's £35, which at that time was a bloody fortune.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, yeah?
And my mum immediately said, yes. Well, wow, that was easy. And I got the kit and everything. Rehearsed in the shop quite a bit. And I found that I could play. I never had a lesson or anything. Not well, but I could play and certainly keep time, and then learned how to use the bass drum and the hi-hat and whatever. After about a couple of months, my mum said to me, you know, I'm so pleased you can, you know, you're playing drums, because that's what your dad did. He had a dance band, and my dad's name was Charles Thomas Bevan, but the dance band was called the Bev Bevan Trio. And so that's how I got my name. I was actually named.
Wow.
After my dad's stage name. So it's all a bit spooky, really.
That's fabulous. And then you had no idea, obviously, until your mum, after the drum kit's already arrived, that this backstory.
Yeah. And then my mum showed me a couple of things, like, you know, she'd still got them, like tickets to local dances and things, you know, dancing to the Bevan Trio. Yeah, lovely.
That's wonderful. How lovely. And at that point, so this is pre-Beatles, pre-Ringo being an influence and all that, I suppose. So who were your influences? What were you consuming as in terms of other drummers?
I didn't know the names. I mean, I loved Hal Blaine was a big influence. Played on all the Every Brother records.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was like Phil Spector and that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And then Phil Spector. Loved what he was doing. And DJ Fontana played for Elvis. Well, and sort of Sandy Nelson came along. And they're all basically American drummers. The only drummers that I saw on TV was when we saw Cliff in the Shadows, and it was Tony Meehan to begin with, and then Brian Bennett. I just listened to records, and because I very rarely saw live music, but there were lots of local bands. And it was in 63 I met Denny Lane. He asked me to form a band with him. We were at a sort of night school together in Birmingham, and he'd seen me play with my little band and liked the way I played. And Denny was the most ambitious, and he's very talented, but he's also very sure of himself. He was positive. He said, well, we'll form a band and we'll become really big. He got so much confidence in himself.
And obviously he did go on. I mean, that's the Moody Blues, and he was part of Wings with McCartney, yeah. Wasn't he? That's right, yeah. So what was the band that you were in with Denny?
I was in, it was called Denny Lane and the Diplomats.
Nice.
And, yeah, and we all dyed our hair blonde, had like sort of shark skin suits, and it really looked the business. And Denny was excellent. He was great with an audience as well. And I found myself getting better and better. We nearly made it. We got signed to Pi Records with Tony Hatch. In the end, Tony had the boss of Pi said, look, Tony, you've got two bands here. You can only have one. You've got to choose one. And he chose the other one, who turned out to be the Searchers. Uh-huh. So it wasn't a bad choice, really.
Fair play.
And the highlights were that we worked with little Stevie Wonder, and we opened for the Beatles. And we opened for the Rolling Stones. So, we really felt we were on the scene, really.
It's such an exciting time for British music then. This is exploding, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was. Yeah, I mean, it was all American. It was pretty awful up till the Beatles. There wasn't much good British music going around. Cliff made some decent records, and I like Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, but there was very little going around. And suddenly the Beatles came along, and, you know, the English music scene took over in America as well. And the turning point for Denny was when we went to see Spencer Davis Group at Birmingham University. And Denny was just totally blown away with Steve Winwood. So talented and so young. He was only about 12. And Denny said, oh, that's it. I'm not doing any more of this pop crap. He said, I'm going to be a blues singer. And he just left and formed the Moody Blues. So we carried on. We replaced him with a couple of guys, but he was never as good. And we folded after about 6 months.
It's always difficult when the guy's name's in the band name. So presumably you became the Diplomats, did you, without the day? Yeah.
Yeah. And we got a couple of really good guys in, but they weren't up to Denny's sort of standard. So we folded. And then I got invited to join a band called Carl Wayne and the Vikings. We went off to Germany and did that horrendous German stint. A lot of bands did it, including the Beatles, where you were, I mean, it's slave labor, really. I mean, no nights off, 7 nights a week, and you do 7 45-minute spots a night in the weekdays, and then 10 at the weekends.
10?
10 45-minute spots. You learn how to play, though, and you get tight.
But your wrist must be knackered, because for a drummer, it is, and you know, a lot of people are like, you're just sat behind the kit. You know, it's like, that's hard work, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. But you're only at Chaos young, you know, fit, we all were. And then we came back, and Carl Wayne and the Vikings weren't going. They've been around for years, so they were never going to make it. And meanwhile, Ace Cafford and Trevor Burton had met David Bowie. I think he was David Jones at the time, but he played at the Cedar Club in Birmingham. He was obviously going to make it. And Trevor and Ace asked his advice. You know, we want to be rock stars. What should we do? You know, and he said, well, just form the best band you can. Just look, he said, there's hundreds of bands in Birmingham. Just pick out the best guys, rehearse like crazy, get yourself to London, get yourself a manager. And that's the way to do it. And that's basically what happened, because they asked Roy Wood to join them. And then they asked me. There's rumors that they asked John Bonham first, but I've never got to the bottom of that one. And that's Carl Wayne. And so we became The Move. We did rehearse like mad, and we were the tightest band I've ever been in was the original 5-piece Move. Amazing. And we got ourselves to London. We got a Tony Secunda managed us. The real coup was getting us a Thursday-night residency at the Marquee Club. That was such a massive thing. But on stage, the four guys had all the dance moves and stuff as well, as the 4 or 5-piece harmonies. Within 3 months, we got record companies queuing up to sign us.
When you say that, the interesting thing of that as well for me is it's a similar to Paul Weller's band at the moment, where you've got a lot of people who can sing as well as play. So even, you know, the bass player, the guitarist, even the drummer Steve Pilgrim in Paul's band is a singer songwriter producing his own stuff. All of those guys could sing, including yourself. Yeah, you've got lovely vocals, all of you, haven't you?
Yeah, it's unusual. Yeah, you're right about Paul. I love Paul's band, so they're all very talented in their own rights, yeah.
That band, you mentioned the Germany stint before that, but even, you know, when we get to The Move, you were gigging a lot, weren't you? You were touring all the time.
We sure were, yeah. Our first record went to number 2 in the charts, Night of Fear. And I Can Hear the Grass Grow was a top 5 hit. And then Flowers in the Rain was another massive hit. And it was also the first record played on Radio 1.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, Tony Blackburn, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and then Fire Brigade, another massive hit. And then Ace Cafford left. He had some mental issues, really, and didn't help with the amount of drugs he was taking as well. And Trevor Burton had the same problem. He took every drug known to mankind. And we had a number one with Blackberry Way, and Trevor Burton left. I've never heard of anybody in a band. You're number one in the charts and you leave the band.
A bit like Paul when he calls it a day on the jam, you know, the biggest band in the country at the time, but different reasons, obviously.
Yeah.
There were a couple of people. I mentioned that we were talking on Facebook, right? And a few of the fans got in touch and wanted to ask me some questions. So I'm going to weave these through out as well, because you mentioned Fire Brigade there. And this is Nick Butler on Facebook. He said, Fire Brigade has got to be one of the best 1960s singles ever. I listened to it first after hearing Paul Weller name check it, a musical education. He said, check out the album Something Else by The Move, just amazing. And then Mark Eggins on Facebook said, did he ever consider The Move to be a mod band? So two questions for you. Did you know that Weller was name checking that song ever?
I'll tell you my favourite Paul Weller story is that about 10 years or so ago, he phoned me to ask me to play on the Wake Up the Nation album. And I don't even know where he got my number from, but he said, I'm such a massive Move fan, man. So I love The Move and The Who. And he says, but I got to tell you, you're not my first choice. I said, oh, okay. He said, no, he said, I wanted Keith Moon. He said, but he's been dead 20 years. So, I know you can play like Mooney, so I want you to do that. So I said, yeah, absolutely.
I love that. Well, we'll dig into that story around that session in a bit. Did you ever consider The Move to be a mod band?
Well, it was the time of mods and rockers, and it's quite a big deal at the time. And there were proper like battles going on with mods and rockers. But I think that maybe that Woody and Trevor Burton and Ace Cafford were quite mod, really, yeah, in the way they dressed and everything else. Me and Carl Wayne were more rockers, really. It didn't matter, you know,
You weren't fighting in the band, having your own mods and rockers battle. You mentioned that residency at the Marquee, and there were so many stories about that and this stint of your manager and stuff that came up in research, where it seemed like, well, you were dressed as gangsters when you performed. Was that right?
Yeah. Tony Secunda was a genius of a manager in some respects. He was publicity mad, and he loved the Rolling Stones, and he loved the... first thing he told us is you don't smile, you know, on photos, no smiling. And he took us to Savile Row to have these incredibly expensive suits made, you know, gangster style suits. And it was a really cool image. Suddenly, you know, before we dressed like the Who, really, you know, the mod trousers and all that stuff. Secunda was brilliant like that. And he had a guy called Bobby Davidson, photographer, excellent photographer, who's still around, actually. He came with us just everywhere. We had thousands and thousands of photos taken. I remember going to Glasgow and we had a lot taken in the Gorbals, you know, the really unpleasant area of Glasgow, with these really scruffy little Glaswegian kids around us. It was such an image, you know. A big mistake he made was that he got us sued by the Prime Minister by having
yeah, what was the story about? There were two stories I saw in research. One was that your first album had been stolen, and then it got found and was given back. Did that actually happen?
No, that was all Secunda. Roy Wood is a fantastic songwriter, but he's not prolific. And we got a couple of hit singles, and we wanted to release an album, and Roy just couldn't write quickly enough. So that's why there's a lot of covers on that first album. We were just stalling. Tony Secunda was stalling for time, so he just made up that story, and of course, more publicity.
But then the Prime Minister's story is an actual thing, wasn't it? So this was, what was this? This was a cartoon for Flowers in the Rain, a cartoon like postcard, wasn't it, for the single?
Yeah, yeah. And he sent it to all the newspapers and even posted it through Number 10. And of course, the reaction was that he just thought, I don't know why he did it. It was a really dumb, he didn't even tell us he was doing it.
And what was it? It was Harold Wilson in bed with his secretary. Was that it?
Yeah, cartoon of that, yeah, basically.
Right.
Of course, Harold Wilson took offence and sued us. And we ended up having to pay all the court costs, and we lost all the royalties from Flowers in the Rain and the B-side, Here We Go Around the Lemon Tree. And most unfairly of all, Roy Wood lost all the songwriting royalties, which would have amounted to, by now, he's probably lost a couple of million on that.
Wow, jeez. So presumably he doesn't exist as a manager for you guys much longer after that, then?
No, we party company. Tony Secunda, he died quite a few years ago now. But he was some character, yeah.
Yeah, what a story, my goodness me. Now, you mentioned Weller loving the move. Did he ever talk to you about ELO? Was that a thing in his world at all?
No, when I went down to, is it Black Barn Studios? Yeah. Oh, that was great. Oh, I loved it. The fact that he got posters on in the studio of The Move and The Who and Small Faces. I think there were others, maybe The Kinks. But no, I don't think he was an ELO fan particularly, but he did love The Move. I got this. You can see it. I'm not going to hold this up. Can you see that?
Nice. Cheers, Bev. Top man, Paul. And there's a signed picture of you. And
that's Carl Wayne. That was when we met Paul at Abbey Road Studios many, many years. Because bloody hell, it must have been way back in the 80s, I think, 90s. And that's when Paul told us he was a massive fan and could have his picture taken with us, you know.
I love it. So he's just, yeah, just a fan who wants to get his photo with his band, yeah. One of his bands, one of his loves, right?
Yeah, and so I went to the studio and recorded a couple of tracks in one day. And he was lovely. He still is. I mean, after seeing him on June the 9th at Cannock Chase Bowl.
Oh, you've got tickets, have you?
Before the lockdown, Paul played this concert, and we tried to get tickets, and it was completely sold out. And I still got my contact number for him from when I recorded with him. So I phoned him and said, "And you know, any chance of, I don't mind paying, but can we get a couple of tickets?" And he said, "Oh, leave it with me, man. We weren't expecting a couple of comp tickets." But when we got there, his tour manager guy met us, took us backstage into Paul's dressing room. We ended up having dinner with Paul and his wife and his kids. And then Paul said, "Come on." And he picked up two drum stools, took us up to the stage where the support band were playing at the time, and put these two drum stools actually on the stage. I mean, not back on the side of the stage, on the stage, and sat us down there. And we just watched the show, his show, sitting on stage. Everyone in the audience could see us. And he was just so lovely. It really was.
That's brilliant. I think that photo, I think I saw a photo of you with the guys from Stone Foundation at one of the Forest gigs. So that would have been that, yeah?
The one, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
We're doing the same again. I don't know whether we'll be sitting on stage again, but I texted him when John got married about 8 months ago, and he was really delighted for us. He's a lovely man.
That's really nice. I love the fact that people in the front row and that would be looking on stage going, who are those two sat on the stools? Yes.
Exactly.
Oh, they might recognize you. Go, where's Beth Beffert sat on the stool? Yeah. Is he going to play? What's happening? Let's talk ELO and this band that comes after the Move. It's almost like a side project of the Move, isn't it? And then split the Move. Was the intention always to split the Move for a new band? Why was there this kind of crossover?
Well, because it was the record company one. We just had our 10th hit with California Man. And that was another massive hit.
That's a great tune, man. God.
Yeah. I like it. And the record company were very happy with the Move. But the Move by this time, Carl Wayne had left as well. So it was myself, Roy Wood, and Jeff Lynn. And Jeff and Roy had very much got this idea of forming this new band, which turned out to be Electric Light Orchestra. But we were contracted to do another Move album, which we did. Actually, it's a good album called Message from the Country, all Jeff and Roy songs. That helped pay for recording the first ELO album, really. It wasn't a massive success at all, but we had a 105 throughout Overture was a big hit single off it. And then Roy left.
And I have to ask you about that song, right? So where is it? So Andy Kennedy on Twitter, he said, how did ELO not sue on hearing Paul Weller's riff on The Changing Man, which is the same as 10538 Overture? Did you know? I mean, you know this, obviously.
I've heard about this, and I checked it out, and I wouldn't have spotted
it. It's pretty similar, you know what
I think? It is pretty similar, but, you know, I didn't write the song, and he's very welcome to it.
These days, there'd be a whole massive court case, like Ed Sheeran's style, wouldn't there? But, you know, and it feels a bit like the Jam and the Style Council, where Paul Weller created the Style Council because he felt he was restrained by the Jam, couldn't do what he wanted to do in the Jam. Was it that ELO was, the vision for ELO was such an evolution from, and so different from what the Move were, that you couldn't just do that in that Move framework?
No, you couldn't. In fact, it was very ambitious what we did. It's one thing in the studio, you know, using classical instruments, but when you have to go out and do it on stage, it was a real mess. I mean, I think that's probably why Roy left, because it sounded terrible, really. We'd got the cello and violin, French horn. Roy was playing cello as well. We did a tour like that, and it was bloody awful. So Roy, he obviously didn't like the way it was going, and he went off and formed Wizard, immediately had massive hit records with Wizard. Jeff and I, basically, along with Richard Tandy, reformed ELO into a seven-piece, and we started touring America. And we found these pickups called Barkus Berry pickups, which you put on the cello, the cellos and the violin. And it worked. You could hear them along with a regular rhythm section, basically, seven-piece. And we started really doing what the Move had never done. The Move should have gone to America and toured, and I think we'd have done well. But that was bad management from Tony Secondi. We didn't do that. But we were determined with ELO to crack America, and that's what we did. Our first gold album, first big hit album was El Dorado, and our first big hit single was Can't Get It Out of My Head. They're both massive in America, and neither one of them were hits in Britain.
The interesting thing as well, when you talk about that, there's a difference between creating this in the studio, obviously, and manipulating it with tape as it would have been at the time and layering things up and doing that on the road. And this was really like the first time that had been done, because you think about the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper's got all those kind of effects and distortion and playing things backwards and layering things up and all that, but they never talk.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Or any of that stuff at all, did they? From after, what, 66, something like that, I think, wasn't it? Their last gig's life. So, yeah, you really were breaking the mold and kind of pushing forward with what could be done on stage.
Massively influenced by the Beatles. I mean, totally. We're just huge Beatle fans and loved what they were doing in the studio with George Martin, the incredible things they were doing with classical instruments to a much lesser degree, but we took it on the road, yeah. And it was very different, and no one had ever seen any like it. And the Americans took to us. We ended up doing another big breakthrough for us. We did a huge, huge tour with Deep Purple as special guests. We almost ran 50, 60 stadium-type shows. And they were great guys to work with. I've known guys out of Deep Purple for a while. So we learned how to play the big arenas as well. And then, so when we came to top of the bill, sort of following year, we felt at home doing it.
And it's also around that time where people start thinking about lighting and how you visualize those types of shows on a huge, big stage as well, which ELO were absolute masters of that type of thing too.
Yeah, well, because we had Don Arden managing us. He was ambitious. And of course, his daughter, Sharon Arden, she became Sharon Osbourne in later life. They had great ideas. You know, that, I think we were the first band to use lasers, for instance. And the spaceship tour was pretty extraordinary.
yeah. I love the idea. Like we're just brainstorming in a room, coming up with these ideas, you know, for a tour. But you lot actually then made it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. The spaceship tour, we needed like two sets of crew. So you do like an A show and a B show, because it took 24 hours to set it up. So the spaceship tour, there'd be crew to set the spaceship tour up. But then we do like a non-spaceship gig the night before with a different crew, then move on to the next town and do the spaceship tour, and then move on back to the other one.
That is amazing. I love this. And Kenny Wheeler, Bill Wheeler, if you're listening, Paul's tour management team, you see, you've got it easy. And actually, yeah, Roger Noel, head roadie for Paul Weller as well. You got it easy, guys. Come on. You're not having to build a spaceship, for goodness sake.
And the audiences could not believe it when that spaceship opened up and all the smoke and the lasers and the noise, the sheer noise of this spaceship opening up and closing down. There's no any other show you go and see, the band close the show, go off, need always come back and do an encore. There's no way there's going to be an encore with the spaceship. The hall closed down.
Are you locked inside?
The audience were just like in disbelief almost. I mean, it was an amazing tour and it got great reviews, yeah.
The thing about this band as well were, I mean, it's not the visuals and the live performance and that, but my God, the back catalog, the songs you had in your armory. When we think about songs like Living Thing and Telephone Line and Sweet Talking, well, Don't Bring Me Down, all these great songs. And it was really interesting. The other day we were watching, me and my 8-year-old watching Guardians of the Galaxy 2 in preparation for the new film. And the whole opening sequence, I don't know if you've seen it, is Groot's at the Tiny Tree and Mr. Blue Sky. And you're like, my God, what a banging tune.
I've been lucky with some real geniuses, really. I mean, Roy Wood is some writer, you know, amazing. And then Jeff Lynne. And then I go on with Black Sabbath and I'm working with Tony Iommi. These guys are just brilliant.
And the sound was constantly evolving and it's huge across the entire planet. Like you say, you know, these multi-platinum albums in the US, Canada, Australia, UK, Europe. It does come, you know, it does take off here. But in the meantime, in the UK, something's happening. And we're talking punk and the start of Paul Weller's career. And what did you make of that? Because it was obviously so different from what you were doing. But what did you make of punk? What did you make of the Jam?
Well, for a start, we were working that much in America and around the world that we weren't in England that much. But of course, I was aware of it. I really didn't like the Sex Pistols. I was a bit snobby in thinking, well, they can't play. You know, well, how good? That's not right. But actually, I thought the Jam I like them. They did remind me of the Move a bit, you know, the suits and they're very tight as well. So I like them.
It's also, I guess, that thing of the hours putting in terms of, you know, as a young age, the hours putting in to make it sound that tight, make it sound that good. They did their work, didn't they? You know,
exactly. Just as the Move did. Yeah.
Now, when we get to the Style Council, again, a similar period for you where ELO are on top of the world. There's a drummer called Steve White. I don't know if you've ever crossed paths with Whitey at all.
Absolutely.
I thought you probably would have done, right?
I was sort of compare something called the World's Greatest Drummers thing in the Midlands Coventry, I think. And it was well done, and I had to do my research. And he was on that bill, and got to meet him and hopefully bump into him again soon.
I wonder what the collective noun is for a group of drummers all in one space. The world's greatest drummers all in one room at the same time. Wonderful.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. One of your listeners will
think of that. He actually asked, I asked him if he had a question for you, and he said he has. So he said, who are you listening to as a young drummer, your influences, and what do you think is the difference between great British drummers and great American drummers? And he says, please pass on my kind regards, Dan. So I'll do that as well.
I haven't mentioned John Bonham. And when the move started, John Bonham used to come and watch me play. And I was the loudest drummer in the Midlands. And I think I influenced John a bit. And then he joined Led Zeppelin. And we became good friends, me and Bonzo. And he just overtook me. He became just amazing. John is still my favourite drummer. What he could do with one bass drum was like unbelievable. I then became the second loudest drummer in the Midlands.
I mean, this is going to sound like an utterly ridiculous question, Bev, so I do apologise, right? But never been behind a kit, never drums in my life. Is it literally how hard you hit it makes it louder? Where you hit it? What is the thing about that?
Well, yes, it is a physical thing, yeah. Keith Moon was loud. I used to love Moon. Mooney was all over the place, but I loved watching him play. And Paul Weller loves Mooney as well. It is that, yeah. It's how hard you hit those drums and how hard you use those foot pedals. And it's physical. It really is. Yeah.
This is not a relaxing instrument where we're just chilling. It's, you know, it's because even like Paul's just started his European tour last night, and these sets are like 2 hours long, and you would have been the same thing on these big stadium tours you're doing. Big long shows. And that's a long time to be putting that much effort into anything, isn't it?
The hardest gig I had was when I joined Black Sabbath. Yeah, for physicality.
Yeah.
that was in 1983. I did two American tours, a European tour. We headlined Reading Festival. And we had Ian Gillan as lead singer at the time. Tony Iommi on guitar, and he's a butler on bass. And a guy called Jeff Nichols on keyboards, who you couldn't see. He was hidden away in the side of the stage. But I went back a couple more times. And Tony remains my... He was just his best man at my wedding, Tony, a few months ago.
Oh, nice. I love all these connections. And you keep... When friendships are made with you, Bev, they stay friendships, don't they? They're lifelong things.
Well yeah, I'm still in touch with... I still keep in touch with Roy Wood and Denny Lane. I haven't seen him, but we keep in touch. I have lost touch with Jeff Lynne, but, I still think he's one of the... You know, what he's done for the music industry is just remarkable, and a dream come true, because he was such a Beatles fan, and then to end up working with them, and in that last couple of John Lennon singles that he restructured, and then the Traveling Wilburys. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I know, God, absolutely. And well, let's all weller. So Wake Up the Nation was the album, and Paul invited you to play on a couple of songs, Moonshine, the album opener, I think, if I'm right to say, and Wake Up the Nation, the title track. Yeah. And I love this story, the fact that he told you he was second choice and that Mooney would have been first choice. But they were such big fans of the move and what you were doing, him and Simon Dine, the producer on that as well. And he said that it was like him being a 10-year-old move fan again, which I thought was lovely.
Yeah, he's obviously a genuine fan. I mean, he even said, you haven't got any old stage gear, have you, that I could have? And you would have been welcome to, but I wish I had kept him. He was a genuine fan, which is lovely.
Yeah, brilliant. And obviously, Paul has a drummer in the band. It wasn't Steve White at that time. It was Steve Pilgrim. So there must have been something that he wanted from you to bring to those songs, to bring to that sound that's something a bit different, which is always nice. But what was the brief? What did he say he wanted from you?
He said, I'd like you to imagine what Keith Moon would play on these tracks and, you know, do the same. And that was fine by me, because I'm a Mooney fan anyway, and I like his style. So he influenced me, Keith Moon.
Now, my impression of Keith Moon on the drums, I mean, incredible, but it's Animal from the Muppets. It's pretty frenetic. You know, it was that it. You had to bring that energy.
I'm not sure that he kept time that well. Mooney, because he was such an animal. But he had, in John Entwistle, and he was an amazing bass player too. And I think he held it together. He held it back, brought Mooney back if he was getting out of time, you know, getting too excited.
So Charles Reese was the engineer in the studio that day. So Charles, he says, ask him about his ride cymbal. He's got a wonderful solid groove and makes the drums sound deep and tight with a dash of laid back. Great guy to work with. Absolutely loved that session. So yeah, tell me about your ride cymbal.
I think it's Zildjian. All my cymbals are from Aegis Zildjian. It's just one that I picked out. You know, Zildjian invited me to, I think it was in Boston. And I've still got them to this day. I mean, they're amazing. I've got two great ride cymbals. One with a massive bell, like a 10-inch bell in the middle of it. It used to work well on Mr. Blue Sky. Bunk, 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 bunk. That one, yeah. On the record, that's actually me playing a fire extinguisher, if you want a bit of trivia. Yeah.
I had no idea about that. Why? Did you not have a drum kit around, or it just sounded better, or what?
We were very experimental and trying to do different things, you know. And I spotted, obviously, you can have a fire extinguisher in a studio. I wonder what that sounds like. And Mr. Blue Sky, bunk, 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 bunk. That's the
fight. I'm going to hear that song in such a different way, which is hilarious, given how many times I've heard that song, you know. Now, suddenly, we're all going to listen in a slightly different way than we have before. I mean, the lovely thing, Bev, as well, is that you're still making music. You're still playing live with your band as well. This is still such a big, important thing for you. I mean, this is, if we cut you in half, there's a pair of drumsticks in there somewhere, right?
Yeah, well, for years I've been touring with the Bev Bevan Band and a show called Stand Up and Rock with Jasper Carrot, where Jasper comes on and does half-hour comedy. Then my band, we go on and do 30, 40 minutes. Jasper comes back on, does another half hour. Then we go back on and do more music. And then we let Jasper come up at the end and play a couple of Status Quo songs.
This sounds like the best night ever, man. I need to get... Where's this in Birmingham?
This has been doing great business about the last 10 years all over the country, really.
I need to get one of these. This sounds fabulous.
Well, he reckons he's retired now from doing that. But he might change his mind, who knows. And for the last few years, I've also been with Quill. My wife, Joy, is the lead singer. We recently released an album called Riding Rainbows, which I'm really proud of. There's some great, great players in it. A lovely Kate McWilliam, fiddle player. She's superb. Abby Brandt, there's three girls in the band. He's a wonderful keyboard player and a good blues singer, bluesy type singer. Phil Tree on bass, who's a really good singer too. And Lee Evans on guitar, extraordinarily good guitar player. Quill are a really good band. We're going in the studio in June to make a new album, which is provisionally called Midland Beat, because we're going to do cover versions of songs by Midland bands. So it'll be The Move and ALO and Black Sabbath, but Duran Duran, Ocean Colour Scene.
I was going to say, you need a bit of Ocean Colour Scene in there, don't you? Simon Fowler, Steve Craddock, and all that, yeah?
Steve Winwood, Moody Blues, Slade. I think it'll be a really good album now, and then we start touring only around the Midlands in October, December.
Okay, and Quill have been around for a long, long time, haven't they?
Joy formed this band, which was at school. So this is our 50-year anniversary.
No way, wow.
Yeah, well, Quill's 50-year anniversary, not mine.
Yeah,
so it'll be fun to tour as that. This July, it'll be 60 years since I opened with Denny Lane, the Diplomats, for the Beatles.
And I bet that time's passed in like a blink of an eye, right?
Yes.
But so many highlights in a career that continues. You must absolutely still get such a kick out of performing live and making new music as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I still get a thrill out of it. I just bought myself an electronic drum kit, which I've never had before, so I can play at home and not make a racket. And I'm really enjoying that, learning these new songs that we're going to record. And I've still got so many drum kits. I've got like five drum kits. I've still got my original kit from ALO, my kit from Black Sabbath, the kit that I used with Quill. I've just been re-sponsored again with Signia now. So yeah, it's still all happening.
I mean, I won't ask you where you keep these. Presumably they're not at home though, right? In the front room, all these drum kits set up.
They're only stored in a sort of a garage. So,
I mean, I feel for Joy because it must be, I mean, thank goodness you're getting the electric kit because it must be quite hard living with the second loudest drummer in Birmingham, right?
Yeah, yes, it would. It's not the quietest of instruments.
Hey, Bev, look, this has been so lovely. I've loved chatting with you. I mean, thank you for the music. I say this to a lot of my guests, but, you know, these songs mean so much to people. And they're, you know, the fact that we're talking about these songs, like you say, like, you know, from, you know, 50 years plus years later, is remarkable that these are, you know, these are part of the fabric of our culture, of our country, isn't it? That must be such an amazing feeling to have that legacy with you.
Yeah, it is. And we play music all the time, you know, and I feel the same way about. I've got lots of favourites, you know, going back to the Beatles, if you like, or Elvis, or well, you know, music is just so important. That's the fabric of our lives almost.
Hey, look, this has been so lovely. I've got two questions for you before you go, okay? So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What would you go with?
Well, I'd like to hear Wake Up the Nation again, actually.
That's a tune and a half, that. It's a terrific song. Because also, I guess, in the studio, you weren't playing that live with a band because he was layering things up on Pro Tools and stuff like that, yeah?
It was quite a weird session in that respect, because I think I put the drums on last, which is, you know, unusual. So drums generally go down first and you build on that. So to do it this way it's not the easiest way to record.
And were you hearing it all together? You were hearing the completed song with Paul singing on it and then playing along?
He sent me the demos. I don't know the vocals on, but the everything else was there. Yeah. I think there was only Paul there, as I remember, and obviously the engineer and producer.
Steve Craddock's on Wake Up the Nation and Terry Edwards on saxophone, but they weren't there with you at the time,
no,
were they?
No.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because you're making music with people that you maybe have never, ever met.
Yeah, well, that does happen, doesn't it, in the industry, yeah. You know, You Don't Bring Me Flowers in Mill. Diamond and Barbara Streisand, and they never even met each other. So they just did it separately. And I said, yeah, these things happen.
And such a different world then, whether you're building stuff up on a computer, layering stuff up versus layering up on tape, which you were having back in the day, you were having to do it that way with the early days of ELO and all that.
Oh, the Move days in particular, the tape, you could become almost transparent. You know, you can't get anything more on it, you know. Yeah.
Final question. So the purpose of this podcast, Beb, is for me to meet lovely people like yourself, to hear your memories of your story, of your career, your life, and those connections with Paul Weller. But it's for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. I was a radio presenter. I gave it up. That was my one big regret. And I never got to interview Paul. I've never got to interview Paul. So I created a podcast. We're now on episode 140 plus, and it still hasn't happened, I should add. So, you know, Paul, if you're listening, come on, get in touch. But if it happens, what should I ask him, Bev? What would you like to know from Mr. Weller?
I think I know the answer, though, really. I mean, why did he leave the Jam? But then I think we probably know, because he wanted to expand.
Such a brave decision, though, that, isn't it? When you're top of the, like you mentioned, you're top of the charts, top of your game, top of the tree, biggest band, and then bosh, you just overnight done.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear him explain that. Absolutely.
And as somebody who's been in this industry for such a long time, are there questions that you appreciate? Are there things that, you know, when you're interviewed, because you're also a radio presenter as well, we should mention this as well, right, with the BBC. So, you know, full respect and all that.
I don't have a BBC show anymore because the BBC have become. The local
radio thing is a scam.
A lot of my pals have lost their jobs. But it was just a once-a-week show for me. It was a fabulous show because it was 2 hours long. With the BBC, there's no adverts to worry about. And I could play anything I wanted. And I've got a pretty massive record collection. And so that's what I did. I like playing songs saying to people, listen to this, you might not have heard this before. And one of my favourite Paul Weller albums is his cover album.
Studio 150 is great, isn't it? Yeah.
Right. And so I used to play tracks from that. People weren't aware of it. And I used to love it, introducing people to people they probably never heard of, someone like Mickey Newbury, who's one of my favourite songwriters. I used to like the education bit of it, you know, I think I was educating or turning people onto things. They may not have liked it, but good chance they did, and they thanked me for it.
It's so important that, because I think in a world of algorithms now and Spotify and things, those little endorsements, those, and you get that from Weller all the time as well, where he's recommending an artist or a band, and then suddenly you open yourself up to not just new music, but the back catalogue and all that. And I think the power of great radio presenters when they're introducing you to new music and new bands, new acts. And by that, I just mean new discovery. I don't mean necessarily bands that are just starting now, but you're telling us about stuff in the past. And that's so important. And I think the local radio thing, the BBC it's an absolute scandal. I started at the BBC local radio, and you're losing these huge big personalities. And where you are, there's some massive personalities who've been on the radio for like 25, 30 years who had to apply for their own jobs. It's an absolute disgrace.
I know. I was in the BBC yesterday doing a show with a guy called Paul Franks. who's a terrific presenter, but his show it finishes in a couple of months, and he's a great loss. You know, he's so good at what he does.
Yeah, and so ingrained in the local community, and they love what they do. They're so brilliant what they do. So yeah, but so is there no radio for you at the moment at all, or are you doing it elsewhere? Or
no, I'm not doing any radio, I've been very busy of late, and come the coming months with the new album and touring and whatever. But I wouldn't rule it out.
Before you go, then give me a couple of recommendations. Now you haven't got the radio show, you must be itching to tell people about things to listen to.
Well, I do reviews in the Sunday Mercury, so I get stuff sent to me to listen to and to review. It's mostly retro stuff, and I'm getting what is lovely though. I'm getting loads of vinyl now sent, because vinyl's coming back big time. I had a great one recently. I had a Mark Bolan album called Rockin' and Rolling. It was only released in Japan back in 20 odd years ago, and it's probably the best Mark Bolan album ever. It's really fabulous.
That's a great recommendation. Okay, well, we're all going to dig into that, Beth. We're going to go and find that. Hey man, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for sparing the time. Thank you for connecting, and thanks most of all for sharing your stories and your music, mate.
Thanks, Dan. And when I meet Paul, so I'm sure I will, in Canuck Chase, so I'll ask him if he'll come on his show.
Well, bless you, my friend. I appreciate that. Thank you so much, man.
All right, cheers.
My thanks once again to Bev Bevan. Do check out the show notes for this podcast on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. You'll find a little playlist that we've put together of some recommending listening of Bev's playing and songwriting and even singing on there as well, you know. Plus loads of details about The Move, ELO and Quill, as we talked about there as well, including links to how you can see them live this year. A real delight. Thank you once again, Bev. Now, whilst you're on the website, if you fancy it, head to my store. You can get yourself our official podcast mug, t-shirt for the summer, maybe a shopping bag as well. Go on, dive on in there. And if you fancy it, you can buy yourself a virtual coffee. It's only £3 for one. You can subscribe if you fancy it as well. Show your support to the podcast. It's massively appreciated. Let's say hello to some of you who've been doing exactly that over the past week or so. Hello, Martin Morrow. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hello, Brian G. Hi. Thanks, mate. Mike Steer, thank you to you for your virtual coffee as well. Hello to Smeg from the 829 Club. Hello, Jen. Hi, Jen. Thank you so much for your virtual coffee. Hello to Stephen Cartwright. Hello, sir. Hi, Stu Burns. Hello to Jane the Jam Tarts with a Heart. Hello to Nick Keane. Hello, Roger Clark. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hello, Alex McLaughlin. He says, I think it was Dylan Jones talking about the quality of Weller's albums who said that he's due a duffer. Yeah, I think you were right, actually. He says, I might be paraphrasing slightly. No, I think that was pretty much bang on. He said, I feel the same about the podcast, Dan, but every week is brilliant. Sarah J. Morris was a fantastic guest. What a voice. Well, thank you, Alex, and cheers for your support. Hello to Phil Baker. Hello, Night Design. Thank you to all of you for your virtual coffee. You can get involved on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Just head to the store. Do really appreciate all your support. Thanks so much. Don't forget, you can get in touch on social media. If you head to Facebook or Instagram, just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast, or on Twitter, you'll find me at Weller Fan Pod. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcasts. we want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niña Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.